This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And before I introduce my guest, I just want to say a special hello to my son who is listening in today. I want to thank him so much for everything he does for me. Danzy, you are the best. You are a mensch, and you are the true joy of my life. So, now, this is going to be so much fun for me. I can't tell you how much I'm so excited that Doug Brunt is my guest today. Now, I'm waiting. Is he on the line yet?
I'm here.
Doug, hi. How are you?
Great. It's great to be back with you.
Well, it's been too long, Doug. It's been too long, but not because I haven't been thinking of you over these years. Can you believe it? It was 8 years ago.
It's hard to believe. I can't believe how quickly the time has gone and how much you've done.
Wow. Yeah. It and that I lasted, Doug, because at the time when I started this program on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, 2015, Big Ed in the control room, who answered the phone for you here, I think they had a bet going that I wouldn't last a month. But, you know, one of the reasons I did was because of you, because you inspired me. You know, you were my fourth guest, and I had talked to some ladies before. I don't want to be sexist about this, but, you know, it was easy. It was like chatting with, friends. But then to get a real New York Times instant best-selling author, and you were so delightful. I must say, I was giddy.
It was so fun. You're a great interviewer, and it's so fun speaking with you. And I'm not surprised to see you 8 years later still going strong and even stronger.
And actually, I had on with you, I had two guests because we also had a little fella running around, right?
That's right. I forgot about that. Did somebody join our conversation?
Well, he's on the tape. He's on the tape. I've got he's running around. And of course, it was so exciting for me, for so many reasons. As I said, it was just the start, and I wasn't sure, and I wanted to. I never really thanked you to tell you how grateful I was that you immediately overnighted an autographed book to me, and I got it 2 minutes before 10 o'clock. The morning after I interviewed you. And it was so shocking to me because I hadn't, I didn't know something like that could happen. And I remember when I opened the door and I got this box and there it was, and I, to get an overnight box is always exciting. I opened it and I remember my sister who was with me looked at it and she said, "Now that's class."
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. I was happy to do it. I loved our conversation, and I love what you're doing for writers. It's great to have a platform like this for writers to engage with the readers out there, and happy to be a part of the show in any small way. And I'm delighted to hear, it was a good experience for you.
Oh, it was a good experience. I must say, I was a little bit giddy and silly, and that was just what I needed to be. Because I had been so nervous. I when I came in on St. Patrick's Day. I was wearing a green leather jacket, which I'm wearing today. At that time, I was wearing my spike green heels, which I can't wear anymore because of a kickboxing injury. But, you know, I was really terrified. I was shy before I started this program. But one of the things that I discovered through all of this is that there are so many things that link me to the authors that I interview. And one of them is this song that I want to play for you, because it was on my playlist before I interviewed you. And then since the time I talked to you about your book, Ghosts of Manhattan, which, as I told you at the time, I loved, because it was very relevant to me. But I have seen, when I read your book, I saw it as a movie in my head, but I saw it with music, as a musical. So I'm going to play a song for you. And I think of this as our song.
Summer journeys to Niagara and to other places aggravate all our cares. We'll save our fares. I've a cozy little flat in what is known as Old Manhattan. We'll settle down right here in town. We'll have Manhattan, the Bronx and Staten Island too. It's lovely going through the zoo. It's very fancy on old Delancey Street, you know. The subway charms us so when balmy breezes blow to and fro. And tell me what street compares with Mott Street in July. Sweet push carts gently gliding by. The great big city's a wondrous toy, just made for a girl and boy. We'll turn Manhattan joy.
Well, you see why I love that song.
That's beautiful. Who's the artist there?
That's Ella Fitzgerald.
Ella Fitzgerald, right.
And
that's great.
You know, it was on my playlist because of the word joy. I just like that word. That's why I used it when I came out with the idea for the program. And that song ended in joy. And there you are, writing a book called Ghosts of Manhattan. Now, I have seen this. This is the opening credits of the film, okay? And I see Nick Farmer, who I love, your main character. I see him coming out of his brownstone, and I see him, as the credits are rolling, that he's really literally dancing down the street. Just joyous.
And I love it.
And that's the opening credits for the film. So I've already written that part.
Your lips to Steven Spielberg's ears. That
well,
would be great.
Well, really, this is the way the film has to open. It has to, because that's what Nick Farmer is. Nick Farmer has, as I told you at the time, how I love that name. How that it just was so perfect, and it's so iconic for that period of time. His innocence in so many ways, and then what went on in 2008, which, by the way, is very relevant at this moment, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, with all the Silicon Valley Bank.
But this is the opening credits. This is the opening credits, and he's dancing, and then we'll go on with the rest of the movie. But always with that theme that I think Nick embodies, a kind of hopeful, it's an American hopefulness underneath everything else that happens to him in the book.
That's exactly right. Well, you certainly have an eye and an ear for the cinematic. That would be a terrific start. You do capture his character and a bit of his journey, the sort of the arc of his journey through the novel. That's exactly right.
It does. It does. I tell you, it's perfect. And I've seen it, you know, as I said, it's on my morning playlist. I have 10 songs and I alternate. I play different ones different days. But so I play this at least, you know, once, twice a week. And I'm always dancing with Nick Farmerdown through Manhattan.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So that's, you know, now that was the book, of course, that got me going with you, and I just love that book. I think it's a perfect time for you to be promoting it right now, because people are thinking about the stock market. People are thinking about the stock market. And I think it's an easy book for people to understand the stock market. Some of the other books, you know, there have been films made about the stock market. They don't quite capture this part of where there are people who, like Nick, who are put in this position and have to make decisions. So I think it's a perfect time for you to get out there and promote it again.
Well, that's true. It does. It is very sort of zeitgeisty right now, with everything in the headlines around Silicon Valley Bank. And the book does talk, the book is largely about a marriage and this person, as you know, and a marriage in the context of Wall Street and the misaligned compensation incentives around some of these banks that was a huge problem that led to the real estate meltdown in 07, 08, 09, that is, you know, when the book is set. But those same misaligned compensation incentives are still there. And, you know, the rules allow people to take these more aggressive bets, and in certain times they're making tons of money, and that's kind of how it's set up for Silicon Valley Bank to do this. And then when the climate turns, though, there's no incentive for being more measured, being a little bit more cautious and responsible with the money. It's set up to incentivize irresponsibility and bigger paydays immediately, but massive exposure that just gets kicked down the curb later when things come calling.
So here's another recommendation from Patsy with a Z. Get your publicist working on... I'm promoting this book big time.
That's right.
It will sell again. You know, this is what happens, and this is what I discovered with you know, all of the authors I've spoken to over the years. They come out with a book, they have a few months to promote it, it's out there, and the publisher, if they're published, you know, by a major publisher, the publisher puts some little bit of money into promoting it, and then the author does a little bit more, and maybe you have a few months run. And then that's
right.
It. And then nobody talks about it.
That's so true. And then every once in a while, something will boomerang back around, like Sinclair Lewis's book, It Can't Happen Here, which came out in the 1930s or so. Suddenly people found it relevant again. Or E.B. White wrote Here Is New York, and right after the terror attacks of 2001, 9/11, people rediscovered that there was a passage in there about and it was sort of an offhand remark he wrote about this book that was decades and decades ago, but it was about airplanes, you know, having a impact in the city and doing damage, and people sort of thought it was this prescient thing, and all of a sudden everyone's reading E.B. White again for a year or so. So it's funny to see these things boom around, but you're right, that hardly ever happens.
It doesn't
mostly
happen.
You do like a one-month tour, and then you put it to bed.
And then you put it to bed, and nobody talks about it, nobody mentions it, nobody... But that's what I discovered. That's what I do here on Joy on Paper. So often, I will find a book that it's been really funny. You know, I find a book that I like and that was published, you know, maybe before the program or published, you know, a few years ago, and I will call the author and say, you know, I'd like to talk about this book, and they say, who are you? Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
But here is an example. Now, we were talking about this in 2015, and it is relevant today. And so your publicist, you know, with all that you have, and of course with your podcast now, that you are a big shot star behind the microphone too, you have to promote this book, because I think people will enjoy reading it.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. I will call my podcast as soon as we finish up the show here. Get them into gear. That's a good advice.
Exactly. Why should it just be there floating down the Amazon River? You know, you got to do some publicity. Let people know about it. They don't know about it. They're hearing about it now for the first time in 8 years, maybe. Right?
Yeah. I mean, the best way for some of these books to get a second life, of course, is if some producer picks it up and wants to do book to film, you know, and with all the streaming content these days, sometimes people do grab a book off the shelf from 12 years ago and suddenly it's right in the news again because it's getting made into a limited series or something.
Well, I think Ghosts of Manhattan is a perfect one because I see it as a film with music. You know, these where you're sort of sometimes Nick is just has these moments, or there are moments of these musical interludes, sort of like an olden day movie, but with these little in-betweens to break up the horror of 2008, because you remember, as I told you, you know, we suffered here terribly in Florida. But yeah. I think with music and the right actors and the storyline, because it's not... In a way, it's good that it's a little bit, you know, back in time instead of current today. I think having it set back then, it's relevant and it's ready. You've got to make a movie out of it. I told you that, you know, 8 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope, who do you think should play Nick Farmer, his actor? He's sort of like mid-late 30s, so it's got to be... Somebody who can get there on the screen.
Yeah, I can. I'll have to think about that. But you've got two female characters there. That mm-hmm. Woo! Those would be great, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And you
yeah.
have some wonderful scenes. You have fantastic scenes. People, you know, they have to get this book. So now your PR people are gonna, you know, start revving things up, and they'll promote this book, and you'll get a film deal.
I appreciate it. This is the catalyst we need. We're gonna get in high gear on this now.
Well, that's what you should do, because now you've got a new book coming out. My goodness, and this is so exciting for me. I don't know if you realize that I am like a real World War One buff. I mean, I have a lot of books about World War One. So you have to tell us about the new book. I mean, this sounds exciting. The Mysterious Case of Rudolf Diesel, Genius, Power, and Deception on the Eve of World War One.
So as you know, I'm now in the phase, I've already been through the copy edits. I'm kind of done with the day-to-day putting pages on the pile phase of writing, and I miss it so much. It's such a fascinating story with an incredible cast of characters. As you say, it's set in that period just prior to World War One, which is sort of like the early years of Downton Abbey, which is a fascinating period of time. World War One ended all of the empires. You know, the Russian Empire and the Tsar were gone, the German Empire, the Austrian Empire, the Ottoman Empire. You know, the way Europe and the world lived changed on this hinge point of World War One. So those years prior to World War One, I think, are some of the most fascinating in history. The book is about Rudolf Diesel, and everyone knows the last name. They pass this name multiple times a day at a fueling station, on a train, on a marine engine. He invented the diesel engine, which is the dominant form of power production since it came out in the early 1900s. To this day, diesel powers the world, powers global international commerce. Like if we grow fruit in some tropical region of the world, all the heavy machinery, all the farm equipment runs on diesel. It then gets loaded onto a truck. Any vehicle on the road larger than a passenger vehicle is powered by diesel. All trucks are diesel. Then goes to a port where the crane running on diesel loads it onto a boat. All cargo ships run on diesel in the world. Travels across the world, loaded back onto a truck, onto a train. All trains are on diesel. So nothing moves, nothing happens without diesel power. In 1913, just as Europe is on the edge of the Great War, tensions are high, Rudolf Diesel is traveling across the North Sea. He's leaving Belgium for England on an overnight passenger ferry across the English Channel, and he disappears overnight, September 29, 1913. And in the morning, no one can find him on the ship. They just find his hat and his neatly folded coat by the stern rail of the ship on the deck, and he's disappeared. So headlines go crazy because at this point he's a huge, he's kind of been whitewashed out of history, but he was a huge celebrity globally at this time. So his cover, it was the cover story of every newspaper around Europe and in America, around the world, what happened to Rudolf Diesel. And they start speculating that there were two theories behind it, because people started to think he was murdered. You know, they was like, it could have been an accident, he fell over, but it was weird that everything was sort of folded. Plus, the railing on the ship was 4.5 feet high. So it was unlikely that he was, you know, sleepwalking and fell over. Suicide was deemed unlikely as well, because he was traveling with friends, and everyone thought, you know, he's never even mentioned the word, and he seemed happy and fine, and he was rich. So people started to speculate about murder. And one suspect was Kaiser Wilhelm II. He was the last German emperor. And the other suspect was John Rockefeller, the founder of Standard Oil and the richest man in the world. And they thought it might be the Kaiser because over the last few years, the diesel engine had emerged as the only power source for the submarine and the U-boat. Gasoline and kerosene engines didn't work for submarines because they ran on very flammable, combustible fuel. They were very fumey. 100% of boat fires to this day happen from gasoline engines, zero from diesel. You can take a vat of diesel fuel and drop a lit match into it and nothing will happen. The fuel is viscous and thick and not flammable under normal circumstances. It's a longer story, but a diesel engine basically pressurizes the fuel first and then it combusts under high pressure. So, and it also is 4 times more efficient than gasoline. So with a diesel engine, a submarine suddenly is safe. You know, all the crews were dying in submarine fires and things and explosions. And so it wasn't even a useful boat. But with diesel, it became a terrifying offensive weapon with the range to go out into sea lanes, control the sea lanes, and you know, be a stealth weapon to destroy larger surface naval vessels. So every navy around, at every major power around Europe was scrambling to get diesel technology. But it was still a fairly new engine. Diesel unveiled it in 1897, and only in the early 1900s was it suitable then for submarines. But only a handful of people had enough knowledge of diesel technology to build a good diesel engine for a sub. So Kaiser Wilhelm, not only does he want Rudolf Diesel, he wants no one else to have him. But he's friendly with some of the more liberal powers like Great Britain and France, who were rivals to Germany at this time. And so many people thought the Kaiser dispatched German agents to kill him, because he was on his way to London to found a new diesel engine company that was going to build engines for submarines. The other suspect was Rockefeller. And one of the reasons people thought it might have been him was Diesel posed a threat to his petroleum business. He had just, you know, Diesel, Rockefeller made all his money initially on kerosene for illumination. But when Edison introduced the light bulb, the electric light bulb, late in the 19th century, suddenly Rockefeller lost his main source of income. All his early wealth came from illumination. And then that suddenly was gone. And the combustion engine was his new way forward. But Diesel didn't need petroleum. He won the 1900 Paris World's Fair on a diesel engine running on peanut oil. It was, he could burn, even just a decade or so ago, Willie Nelson was running his tour bus with a diesel engine running on recycled kitchen grease. Because he said, I don't want countries today to be running around having wars over energy. And the diesel engine could solve that. It didn't need petroleum. It could also run on a form of petrol diesel, but it could run on vegetable oil, nut oil, anything like that. And so he posed an existential threat to Standard Oil. And so some people thought, well, maybe the oil trust in Rockefeller had him murdered. So anyway, it's a huge mystery about what happened to him.
We don't want to tell people too much because they have to get this book. It's going to be an exciting read.
It is. So I basically spent years in archives and solved the mystery. So you'll have to read to find out what happened to Rudolf Diesel.
Did you see the video I made for you?
I did. I just saw that this morning. Thank you so much.
Okay, because that exactly poses the question. Because what people don't understand is that most people, when they think of U-boats, they think of World War II. They don't understand that the Germans had U-boats at the beginning. Of course, at the beginning, they had very few. But who knows? They got the diesel engine, and boy, oh boy, they had 140 U-boats in World War One, and they were destroying 30% of the merchant shipping.
That's right. It was actually, at one point, Great Britain was worried they were going to be blockaded out. So Great Britain had sort of control of commercial sea lanes, but the U-boat was used. And for a period of time, they stayed away from unrestricted submarine warfare. Some people think if they had done it the whole time, it might have been more damaging to Great Britain and its commerce, and they might have actually been able to kind of starve them out. But yeah, in World War One, they sank the Lusitania, famously. That was, I think, 1915. And they had U-boats that could make it all the way to the shores of North America. And U-boats strong enough and with a range enough to get that far.
Yeah. So that's why this book, the minute I thought, oh, this is so beautiful, because also in, you know, for me, it, my interest has always been Churchill and those early years, how he had foresight and how he understood people and understood countries. And so when I discovered that you were writing this book, I was so thrilled. What was the essential, I mean, when you first got the idea, how did that come about? Because it's wonderful how one little thing can spark, as you've now done, years of research.
That's a funny story. I had just bought an old boat with gasoline engine. And this is going back 6-7 years ago. And I was going to refurbish the boat. And I was talking to some old guy in the boatyard, this old salt guy. And I said, what should I do with the boat? And he said, well, a boat like this really ought to have diesel engines. And I said, why? And then he gave me all the reasons. 100% of boat fires happen with gasoline, not diesel, better range, all the benefits of diesel that to this day are true and are, you know, fundamentally the same design that Rudolf Diesel presented to the world in 1897. So I repowered a diesel. And then I was, like a year later, searching around the internet for ideas for the next novel. And I was just Googling on different search terms, like mysterious disappearances at sea and things like that. I saw a list of that, and I saw Rudolf Diesel. And I thought, I wonder if this is anything to do with the diesel engines I just got. And of course it was. And so when I started to look at it, I thought, well, maybe I'll do a, you know, historical fiction, and this will be the basis of a novel. And as I got into it, I really geeked out on this and went down a multi-year rabbit hole and felt I had actually a theory of what might have happened. And then all my research supported that theory as true. I said, I have to write this as nonfiction. So really, the book is much more like an Eric Larson-style narrative nonfiction book. A powerful piece of history.
Well, I know with your fine writing that you have turned this into a real spellbinder, and that people will be turning the pages to find out what you've discovered. And I love the fact that you've spent years of research, because isn't research fun?
I loved it. I loved getting into those old archives. You smell the old paper and the old blue and the binding and all of that stuff. I love the whole atmosphere of it is great.
Well, I was thrilled when I discovered that, you know, because I had been waiting there for years. I was, write a book already, because, you know, in between we had the means and, you know, but still I knew that there was something big coming. And when I discovered this, I was so thrilled.
Oh, well, thank you. It is going to be big, and it's available. It's posted onto Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all the places you get books, so it's available for pre-order now, and Pub Day is in September.
Yeah, I know. I already put the pre-order link on my homepage. Everybody, you can go to my homepage. I've done a video, and the video is there, and a link for the pre-order, because it's wonderful when you pre-order. People don't understand sometimes how important it is for authors to get pre-orders. It is such a nice thing. If you have a favorite author, please always pre-order their books, because they really, really appreciate it. The publishers note it. And Amazon, most importantly, Amazon notices it, because it goes into their algorithm, correct?
That's right. It really does give an author and a book a lot of momentum. It makes a big difference to pre-order.
So that's what I always try to do when I have authors that I love. I put the links right on my homepage so that people will pre-order them, because if you have them already pre-ordered, the author gets this benefit, this big boost on day one so that their book can shoot to first, you know, number one on the charts, and that's what you want. And as you said, this is not a novel, so it might not, you know, be sort of in that category of a book somebody might be buying, you know, especially nowadays, you know, people have all these series and things. But this, I know that this is going to be an exciting read. Some of the most exciting reads are nonfiction books. And that's why I want to make sure people pre-order it for you. And it will be something really, not just to be proud of, but something that will really set you on another level, you know?
I think so. It actually is incredibly cinematic, and it's an incredible sort of spy caper, in a sense. And one review that has come in early from Jay Winnick, who's a really talented historian and author, described it as part Walter Isaacson, part Sherlock Holmes, and that the book sort of unveils the greatest caper of the 20th century. So it really is a riveting read. It's sort of part biography of Rudolf Diesel, but part, you know, mystery caper.
Well, that's exactly, I knew it was cinematic the minute I started reading about it, because I know the era, I know the background stories. As I said, I love books about World War I, and this is breaking new ground, which is always so exciting. And it's cinematic. So, you know, while they start making Ghosts of Manhattan, it's really, isn't it wonderful? You know, what I've discovered over these years, 8 years, just to see the development and how writers, you know, just find this joy. They'll find one little subject, one little idea, you know, the way you did. And you run with it, and you have so much fun.
It's so true. My editor actually was saying, in my book, there are a number of footnotes I'll have of sort of a side piece of information that's fascinating and relevant. It's a little bit out of the main narrative of the story, but I'll drop a nugget into a footnote. And we were joking, you know, any one of those footnotes could be some other writer's whole book. They could take that and grab it and go and do a whole book on it.
Well, that is the true joy on paper. And, you know, just last month I interviewed a wonderful, wonderful woman who is 100 years old, Eugenia Lovett West, and she's been celebrating her birthday on Joy on Paper for the past 5 years. And she's 100, and she had an idea a few years ago. One of her friends had her ID stolen, you know, and she got interested in cybercrime. Now, she was 98 years old at the time, and she just started doing research and interviewing, you know, doing the research, interviewing policemen, talking to the authorities, talking to FBI guys about, and she writes a book at 98 years old about cybercrime.
That's incredible. That is such an inspiration. I hope I'm as with it and as engaged at that age.
Exactly. And, well, that's partly what I tell people. It's the writing and it's the reading. It keeps you, your all of those gray cells that Hercule Poirot talks about, you know, firing up. And you need to do that, and more people have to do that, both write and to read. And it is a joy, isn't it?
It really is. It does. It just brings new information into you and into the family. You then get it around the dinner table and share some incredible piece of wisdom or information, and it continues to grow from there.
And for writers, of course, it often leads to doing this research that maybe takes you to new places, and you meet new people, and you expand your whole life's base, sort of.
Yeah, I love seeing it begin in my kids. They, you know, they are now big readers, and they come and they share something that they've just learned from a book, and it's just so fun to see, and to see it continuing on to the next generation.
Well, you know, I think it's just remarkable, and one of the remarkable things is that now you you found the joy of being behind a microphone. When did this happen? After talking to me? After I teased you for an hour?
In part. And the origin story here a little bit is that I used to be an executive. I ran a security company, and when I switched to writing, that's a big shift to a solitary lifestyle away from having an executive team and a board and investors and customers and things like that. And so I did miss some of that. And so I started a book club, sort of other writers as I met a few. And some have been guests on your show, like Nelson DeMille and Lee Child and others, Amor Towles. And so we'd get together every other month at my apartment. We'd have a drink and talk for an hour, and then we'd review a book together, usually a dead author. And I was talking to someone a friend at SiriusXM about this. He goes, "My gosh, I would love to hear those conversations with you guys." Because we talk about agents, publishers, and book festivals, and funny stories, you know, challenges and fun things and crazy stories of the sort of writing life, I suppose. Even challenges with a particular novel. Like, I'm really struggling with this thing, or the outline I got to tweak, or whatever. And he said, "That should be a show." And so I made it into a show. So I have a podcast now. It's produced by SiriusXM. Comes out weekly on Tuesdays. You can get it anywhere you get podcasts, whether it's Spotify or Pandora or Apple, whatever. And I talk to top authors.
And it's called Dedicated.
Called Dedicated. We start each show with the guest's favorite drink. So Lee Child was champagne. Just had James Patterson on. He was red wine. Amor Towles is next week. He's Negroni. And then we just talk and we tell funny stories. Some of the authors I know pretty well. Like
I'm Cure Royale, by the way. I'm Cure Royale.
Cure Royale. I love that drink. Chambord, I think, is in there. Is that right?
Cassis, yeah.
Cassis, okay. So I fix the drink right in studio and we have a fun conversation. Some of the authors I'm meeting for the first time. Rick Springfield, for example, was just on. He's actually written two novels and a memoir in addition to a number of songs. So I'll talk to different kinds of writers, too. You know, people who write for TV and film, people who write novels, people who write nonfiction or memoirs.
And I love, of course, I love your logo. I love it.
The martini glass in the book?
Exactly. That's perfect. Yeah. Always makes me want to have a drink. So you're having fun with that, too?
It's been great. I really love it. It's a way to, as again, I said that the writing life is fairly solitary. I spent a lot of time in archives, a lot of time writing, in a room by myself. So it's nice to also break out and fire up some different muscles and meet some new people, too. See some old friends, but see some new people. And also hear their, you know, the stories sometimes are so fun. Some of it's more tactical. Like if you're a new writer and you want to hear how someone does it, it's fascinating for that. And everyone's different. Some people outline obsessively, like Amor Towles and Min Jin Lee. Other people don't outline at all because they think they take some of the gas out of it. They want to have the same experience as the reader, not knowing what comes next. Lee Child does not outline. Brad Thor does not outline. They think, you know, Jack Reacher's in trouble. Even I go to bed not knowing how he's going to get out of it. I'll wake up and figure it out, you know, and there's just more energy in the book that way. And then there are also funny stories, too, like Lee Child in the very beginning, when he was picturing Jack Reacher in his head, pictured Howie Long, the NFL defensive lineman, who's now an analyst. So he ran around in the early days picturing Howie Long as Jack Reacher. And there's just a number of sort of insider funny stories like that, and, you know, funny things that happen at book festivals and all sorts of stuff. And everyone, one question I always ask people is, what is the most difficult or the least attended book event you've ever had? And, you know, by the time these people are on my show, they're big stars, James Patterson and Lee Child. Pretty much everyone has a zero or a one. You know, they went to some bookstore somewhere and they were just starting out and they put out all the chairs and then they just share awkward glances with the bookstore owner. It's like, is anyone going to come to this thing or not? And, you know, Amor was actually saying a zero is better than a one. You know, because a one, you've actually got to stick around and do the thing. If nobody shows up, you're like, all right, you know, we tried. Going home, going to go get a drink somewhere. If one person shows up, you've actually got to do the whole thing.
Well, so. I love Amor. As a matter of fact, one of my most favorite shows and one that got the biggest response from listeners, I had him on along with his narrator.
Oh, fun.
And, you know, that doesn't happen very often where the narrator of a book gets any credit. But Nicholas Guy Smith, his voice was just so perfect for for A Gentleman in Moscow that I had Nick on the program with Amor, both of them, and Nick was reading passages. And after I finished, you know, the program, by the time I got home, I already had emails from people who said, well, I was never going to read that book, but I heard the narrator, and his voice is so good. And, well, and in a way, sort of same results I got with you. Because one of the things that happened after I talked to you, because I was, as I said, I was teasing you, somebody accused me, well, no, a lot of people accused me. They said afterwards, well, you were very flirty with him. Are you allowed to do that? And I said, was I? Yes. Well, I said, well, yeah, because, you know, I just, you know, there's something about him. I just said, I, you know, it was just so much fun. I had so much fun talking to you. And so I was described as being flirty. And people were saying, well, are you allowed to do that on the radio? I said, why not? It's my program. And that's when I really, and you know, actually, that's when I really realized. I said, it's my program. I can,
I can do anything I want.
That's right. Yeah. I can be flirty with you, and then I went home, and my husband had the same opinion. He didn't use the word flirty; that was not a word in his vocabulary. But you know, like,
well, that's right. I mean, whether it's flirty or whatever you call it, it's just sort of part of the magic chemistry, I think.
Exactly.
Call it what you will.
And my husband said that's okay because, you know, I feel that way about his wife. So I thought, well, okay. You know, if you want to flirt with Doug Brun's wife, I can flirt with Doug, right? So it works because, as a matter of fact, my brother, I did tell you this, my brother still carries her picture in his wallet.
And I love that.
He does not have his wife's picture in his wallet.
he can inspire that in folks. He's her voice is stronger than ever, and she's doing great.
Oh, I know. And I tell you, it's so funny because, well, you know, after it would have been like, you know, years after, you know, when they came over after you had been on the program, and my brother pulls out his wallet. He says, well, I can do better than that. I've got her in my back pocket. You know, that's what I discovered here with the fun of being, it's fun to talk to people, isn't it?
It's great. It really is great. And you kind of look through the universe of writers and books and think, you know what, that one somehow I feel a connection with, and you call them up and on they come, and you get to talk about it and meet them and then share that with the listeners.
Exactly. So your podcast is wonderful. I think it's fantastic. It's just so much fun that you're in your way, you're helping authors, and I'm helping authors. Oh, and Nelson DeMille, I must say, I was so grateful when you sent him to me because I love him. Of all the authors I've spoken to, well, he's just holds a special place in my heart because my husband was such a fan of his as well that just even thinking about him and going back and reading his books. Sometimes I just go back and read his books simply because they make me feel just happy and warm. And, yeah. And he's just amazing.
He's such a talented writer, and he's such a good person. Very generous with other writers. You know, he's been a big star for decades, and he's always generous with a piece of advice if asked. And just a wonderful guy. Really, really consider him a sort of a mentor. I mean, I hope I can live up to being the mentee, but he's a great guy.
Well, I sent you an email this morning. Did you get it about announcing?
I did.
Okay.
The prize winner.
Okay. Well, I started this. This year I'm going to do one sort of major Patsy award. And then in another month, I'm going to do some Patsy prizes, which are cash prizes. But the Patsy Award is for a book that really, I think, is important. And for 2022, I have one book that I want to give an award to. So do you want to announce it?
I will. I hope I pronounced the last name correctly. Michael Kiel, K-I-E-L.
Yes.
For his book, Challenge the Moment.
Challenge the Moment. Michael was on my program, and he touched my heart. And in so many ways, he represents exactly what I want people to think about, how lucky we are to have life, to have moments of joy in our life. And Michael was shot in the neck. He was paralyzed in a moment. And so his book, which is called Challenge the Moment, is so heart-wrenching, but also so funny and so full of joy. He has managed, from that moment, he has managed to make a full and complete life. He has traveled. He lectures people. He goes and meets people. He does all sorts of events to help other people who have been injured, who have even injuries not as bad as his, but he inspires them, and he inspires people with this book. And this is also a book that I think should be made into a film, because he embodies everything that is wonderful in a human being. He lost so much, but he's given so much, and he's a very special person. And Challenge the Moment is a beautiful book, and I hope people will get it. And I am also hoping that somebody over there, as you say, you know, in that streaming world, will pick it up and make a film out of this book.
It's an incredible story. One of the things I was thinking about when I read the book description, and I've ordered the book, so I'll read the whole thing. But I know people who have suffered terrible spinal cord injuries and the resulting paralysis, and it is so hard, and you never get to take a break from it. You stuff every minute of every day. It's not like you work really hard and then you take a break, a little vacation. There's no vacation from this. This is hard, hard work every second of every day. And for him to be able to pick up the pieces and build a whole new life out of it,
and travel the world.
It's incredible.
He's managed to travel the world, managed to give so much joy, so much love to other people. And he deserves the Patsy Award. He deserves a lot of awards.
That's a great story. It's very inspiring.
Very inspiring. And so that's one of the things that, you know, well, I wanted to do here on Joy on Paper. And you've made it possible for me really to share it with other people. You inspired me right from the beginning, and as my sister said, you've got class. And really, I'm so very honored that you immediately accepted my invitation to be here on Joy on Paper. I got tears in my eyes. All I did was ask and reached out to you, and you were there, and just like you were 8 years ago. And thank you, Douglas Brunt. I think you're an amazing person, and you have to get out there now and promote Ghosts of Manhattan so I can see the film one day.
I'm on it. Well, right back at you. You are full of clap, and you're doing great work here for writers and readers, bringing them all together, and sharing joy, as your mission has been from the beginning, and you're achieving that.
And I'm so happy to hear that your kids are following in your footsteps and are great readers, because I know that of course was important to you, and that's why you've done so well with everything that you've worked on, all of your books and the new book. Whoa, the new book. Everybody go to my homepage, radio-joy on paper, and there is a link there to pre-order the book. And it is going to be a great read, The Mysterious Case of Rudolf Diesel, Genius, Power, and Deception on the Eve of World War One. I know that you're going to send me a copy early. I'm going to get to read it before everybody else, correct?
That's right. As soon as I get my hands on them, there'll be one on its way to you.
Oh, thank you so much. Again, thank you. Thank you, Doug. Thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. You are one of those golden threads in my life. As I said, the Ella Fitzgerald song ended in the word joy, and then you came into my life with Ghosts of Manhattan.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on. This is my pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye. Thanks. Oh, wow. What can I say? I am so grateful to him. He is such a wonderful person. And so, well, just you don't get many people like that in the world. Although I get many people like that. Do you realize I've talked to over 1,500 people? And the nice thing, again, about my program, it is my program, and I can talk to anybody I want. And so that's one of the fun things that I can... I just contacted Doug 8 years ago, and he immediately responded and came on Joy on Paper, and he's been just wonderful, again, to come on today to celebrate 8 years of Joy on Paper. Wow, there's so many people that I have to thank. It will take me so long. One of the things, check my Facebook page. I'm going to put up some special thank yous to different authors, eventually all 1,500. But I want to give a little shout out to a couple of authors, particularly Gabrielle St. George. Patsy Award winner last year. And when I was talking to her one day on one of the interviews, I had this idea of doing something very special to sort of get the coziest cozy writers together in one little group. And I'm going to do a special page on my website for cozy writers so that I discovered that, for example, I have a lot of women in my condo community, and the ones who learn something about an author are more interested and more likely to buy the author's book, like Tasha Alexander. Everybody in my condo development knows Tasha Alexander because we were going to have a big tea party for her when the pandemic hit, and then we couldn't have it. We had to cancel it. But we've had sort of in between, we've had little mini tea parties, get-togethers, especially around Christmas time, and we've done a grand tour because with Tasha Alexander, you can read her books because Lady Emily, that's her main character, a Victorian sleuth, is a fun character, and she travels all over Europe and a little beyond to Cairo to Turkey. Oh, we're going to play a song, yes. Thank you. We're ending this with this.
WTAN, Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF, Dade City.
FM 102.3.
WZHR, Zephyr Hills.
FM 104.3.
Listen.
It's time for the March Break Thursday edition of Canada Calling. The news from home for Bacon.